Brother Jake. Now, there are a lot of people out there that think that religious freedom in the U.S. isn't being consistently and systematically undermined by an unspoken conspiracy of freedom haters, but they couldn't be more wrong. Let me explain. The thing is, religion is a super important part of our society. This is a Christian nation, which we know because modern-day prophets told us that God inspired the Founding Fathers to write the Constitution. Plus, religion is what gives us morals. Without religion, how would you know right from wrong? Sure, there are some people out there who think it's possible to use logic and reason and basic concepts of human dignity to decide that stuff like murder and theft and lying is bad, but that doesn't make any sense because we all know that once you start thinking that some of the tenets of morality don't necessarily have to be decreed by an omnipotent creator, you basically accept a world of pure murdering, thieving, adultering, coffee drinking, lying chaos with no rules whatsoever. And since the Founding Fathers understood that religion is totally necessary for us not to live in a Lord of the Flies dystopian hell, they put freedom of religion into the Constitution. But that freedom is being chipped away at all over the place, like not being able to have the Ten Commandments in front of courthouses or prayers in schools, and don't even get me started on the war on Christmas. And yeah, some people might be saying, but by allowing Christian symbols on state-owned property, the government would be endorsing a Judeo-Christian branch of religion over other types of religion like Islam or Buddhism, which is kind of the opposite of what the separation of church and state is supposed to do. And I mean, yeah, they kind of have a point, but the answer isn't to take away all the school prayers and courthouse commandments. What we should do is let all religions put up whatever symbols they want in public places. So parks and schools could all have the normal stuff like a cross and a fish symbol and a manger scene and the Ten Commandments, and all the, you know, other stuff like a Buddha and one of those thingies. And sure, public spaces might start to look a little weird if they were all peppered with a bunch of different religious symbols, but it's all about the freedom, dude. Now, some other people might be saying, but letting religions put up statues all over public property doesn't really solve the problem either, since that implicitly favors the expressions of belief for religious people over people who aren't religious at all. And I mean, yeah, it kind of does, but isn't that the point? I mean, just like I proved earlier in a way that was totally not based in unfounded fear at all, society would become an apocalyptic war zone without religion. So when the Constitution talks about freedom of religion, it doesn't just mean that the government shouldn't endorse a specific religion or prevent a belief from being practiced. It means that the government should make sure that religious speech and expression gets special treatment beyond just regular old freedom of speech, and that religious belief is being actively promoted. That's what religious freedom is. It protects freedom of religion, not the freedom to not be religious. And no, religion is not just a code of ethics or moral behavior, so it doesn't count if you say, well, I believe that we can still reach moral imperatives, like not murdering each other by using reasoning and the basic tenets of what makes a society function without relying on a supernatural unseen force. Your morals have to be based in a belief in God to be legit and get super awesome VIP religious freedom protected status. Now, some of you might think that religious freedom doesn't have anything to do with gay marriage, but it totally does. But it isn't because we hate gay people, we love gay people, especially when they don't act gay or do gay stuff. It's just that we love religious freedom more, and gay marriage is a threat to religious freedom, because if the government allows people to legally do something we disagree with religiously, like letting two men get married, it's just a matter of time before they start forcing Mormons to do other stuff that's just as bad, like marrying people to their pets or siblings or refrigerators in our super special VIP temples. And yeah, that might kind of seem like a far-fetched conclusion given the fact that heterosexual marriage has been legal for like ever and we've never been forced to temple marry any heterosexual couples that didn't adhere to our religious standards, it's still a totally real and not based on paranoia at all threat. Because if there's anything that Mormons don't like, it's people practicing a sexual behavior that society disapproves of. So you see, it's all about the freedom.
This is Infants on Thrones. Philosophies of men mingled with humor. We are the Quorum.
Hi, my name is Zach Galifianakis, and this is another edition of Between Two Ferns. I'm your host, Zach Galifianakis, and my guest today is John Hamm.
Hi.
Am I saying that right?
Yeah.
My guest is John Hamm. He's on a show called Mad Men on AMC. AMC?
Mm-hmm.
What's that stand for?
It doesn't stand for anything anymore. They just call it AMC.
Oh, okay.
It's like KFC.
But that stands for Kentucky Fried Chicken.
Not anymore.
Who says that?
They don't call themselves that anymore.
The next thing you're going to tell me is that KKK doesn't mean anything to you.
Well.
You're in the day the earth stood still.
Yes.
Why?
It's a good question.
I certainly don't like to make fun of people's last name because my last name's funny sounding. But does it get on your nerves when people make jokes about your last name?
Well, you know, it's sort of easy.
Is your middle name Honeybaked? Have you ever thought about, for show business, changing your name from John Hamm to like something like John Sausage or Stuart Turkey Link?
Hi, this is Glenn Ostlund from Infants on Thrones, and I'm Glenn Ostlund. And today, I'm chatting not only with Brother Jake, but also with the man behind Brother Jake. Or maybe the kid behind the guy, behind the person sitting just down the hall and to the left of the man behind Brother Jake. And he's really fabulous. Okay, look, I'm not trying to say that I think that I'm like Zach Galifianakis or anything, because I'm not. He's funny and popular and short, and he has a lot more money than I do. But sometimes I just get in a certain mood, and I sort of slip into this random jackass mode just for my own enjoyment. And so it becomes about my own private joke where I pretend to be indifferent or impatient or rude or insensitive just because I think that it's funny. So if I've ever come across as indifferent or impatient or rude or insensitive. So I've been friends with Jake for about 3 years now. I was actually assigned as his home teacher way back in the day because, well, that's what God wanted. And he moved away this past summer, but he came back to visit for Thanksgiving. And we sat down to chat, and he suggested that we record this conversation and that I publish it because deep down, he's a really vain attention whore. So today, you're going to hear Jake talk about a bunch of stuff and me being sometimes interested in what he had to say. I think I stopped playing Xbox about 10 minutes in.
Do you want to state your name for the record?
Yeah, sure. I'm Jake. I'm Brother Jake, I suppose.
Why did you decide to start going by Brother Jake? Isn't that a little bit, like, arrogant?
Why is it arrogant? Like, in what way?
Because you're, like, referring to yourself all honorific and everything. It's like if I went to everybody and I said, "Hi, I'm Elder Osland." Like, I wouldn't want to do that again.
Yeah, ever. But, I mean, I don't mean it, like, honorific. I guess it's because Brother Jake, like, the persona is, like, a caricature. And, like, his caricature is from the perspective of, like, a believing Mormon. Like, within the context of Mormonism. So, like, within the context of Mormonism, believing Mormons refer to each other as brother and sister, right?
Do they introduce themselves that? I guess they do.
Yeah, they kind of do. I mean, I definitely introduce myself. Hi, I'm Brother Frost, Jake, you know? So, like, there's kind of a little twist on that, because usually you go brother and then last name.
And then they did that, name. Like, Janet Jackson, Miss Jackson, if you're nasty. Right?
Yeah. I suppose.
Yeah, okay.
Is that, maybe that was before my time, I don't know.
Was that before your time? Because I'm Janet, Miss Jackson, if you're nasty, nasty. What, nasty when? Boys don't mean a thing.
Yeah, I don't know, I'm not really that familiar with it.
Okay.
I just kind of didn't become aware of music generally until, like...
You're not going to be able to mumble and get away with it.
Okay, I'm not familiar with much Janet Jackson at all.
Yeah.
So, sorry about that.
It's a shame.
Shame.
It's truly a shame.
Damn shame.
Okay, I'm going to move this because it's blocking my view of the Xbox.
Of the televisor.
All right.
So, you know what I was thinking about... So I've been reading Ender's Game, because I went and saw Ender's Game after Bob, and was it Bob that did the thing?
Bob and Logan.
Bob and Logan did their thing?
They did.
And
they did do their thing.
And I reread Ender's Game after I watched the movie, and...
I have not read Ender's Game.
That... I think you would enjoy it. I'm not going to say, like, that's a crime or something, but I think you would enjoy it. I think you'd like it. But I don't see Orson Scott. I can't just write Orson Scott Card off as like kind of just a crazy old guy or something anymore. Because I did, and then when I reread his stuff, I was like, no, this guy is good. I mean, he's just the thoughts that he has are so intriguing and so nuanced and complex that I can't just kind of think of him simplistically like, oh, he's just a crazy guy.
I'm going to need some examples here.
What do you mean? The examples of what, him being crazy?
Yeah, like what's an idea that before you would have thought, oh, this is just crazy, that now you think, no, I can't think of him that way?
Yeah, I mean, it's like, so the, if you ever read his essay, he has this essay called Hypocrites of Homosexuality or something like that. And, you know, it's what you can imagine what it is.
I can't, actually. What's he saying?
I don't remember that. Look, I haven't read his crazy stuff in a while, so.
Okay.
But it's,
so that's the secret.
Not reading it. Yeah, maybe that's it. That's what comes down to. It's easy not to write them off when you don't read the crazy
stuff. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe that's what it is.
Turn it on like a light switch. Just go click. It's a cool little Mormon trick. We do it all the time when you're feeling certain feelings.
So here's the other thing that I want to talk that I was thinking about. So every few months, like, I get really interested. For some reason or another, I get really interested in, like, the ex-Mormon or post-Mormon and apologetic, like, online communities.
Yeah.
You know, so I'll kind of reread the latest stuff and become interested in it. You know,
Where do you go for that? Like, on Facebook, or are you looking at blogs, or?
There's blogs, there's the ex-Mormon.org, there's the ex-Mormon subreddit.
You know, I don't think I've ever been to exmormon.org.
It's such an ugly website. But there's some interesting stuff on there.
What do you mean by ugly?
It's just ugly. It looks like it was designed in 1995. Like, and it just looks terrible.
Yeah.
And it's super hard to navigate. It's not very intuitive at all. But, you know. Anyway, so I started looking at... I started looking into this stuff, and...
The communities.
Right, the communities, and the thing is, it's easy to get bored pretty fast, because basically the same things just kind of cycle over and over. It's somebody had a really annoying conversation with, like, a friend or family member, or it's that somebody had a great... somebody was like, well, if this is true, then how can this be true? You know, pointing out these specific contradictions and... doctrine, or...
And when you say boring, it's like you've heard this, you've come across it before, so it's just not compelling to you? Is that what you mean?
Yeah. Yeah, so it gets to a point where it's just not very interesting anymore, just because you've heard it all before. It's just kind of the same things rehashed. Yeah. And so, but I saw somebody mention on there about, like the ex-Jehovah's Witness community.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went into Reddit, so there's a subreddit,
I don't really know what that means either, but...
Right, so Reddit is the larger website, a subreddit.
Sometimes Jake forgets that I'm old enough to know the lyrics to Janet Jackson songs. No, my first name ain't baby, it's
Janet, Miss Jackson, if you know. So, I started looking at the ex-Jehovah's Witness Reddit, and it was just... And it was fascinating, because they were doing all of the same things. Like, it was, the parallels were very, very strong with this obsession, with people talking about, you know, being ostracized from friends or family because of their disillusionment with the religion, with them having these tirades about how the general assembly, or the governing body, that's what it's called. So they'll talk about how the governing body, which is, you know, a lot like, from what I gather, is very much like the general authorities of, in Mormonism, the governing body of the Jehovah's Witness religion. They'll be talking about how, you know, they did predict the end of the world would come on this date and this date and this date, but then they recanted. But then there'll be all these apologetics that will talk about, no, they didn't really say the world was going to end then. But then, you know, the ex-Mormons will...
Ex-Jehovah's Witness, J-Dub.
Yeah, the ex-Jehovah's Witness will come back with citations of, like, specific, you know, watchtower...
Yeah.
You know, specific watchtowers where it was published. Anyway, it was weird. It was like this bizarro version of what we were, of the dialogue going on within the ex-Mormon community.
Yeah.
And I had I'd never really seen it play out that way. I knew that there are other, you know, there are other religions and they must have ex-adherents, but I didn't realize, it never really sunk in before then how similar they really are. I guess I never really realized that for as all-encompassing as Mormonism can be, and as difficult it is for somebody to leave, or the disappointment or disillusionment that somebody will feel, for as powerful as those emotions are, Mormonism is just unbelievably tiny. Like, it's just such a small blip. Like, the scale is so small when you look at the whole of humanity. And it's not, like, the biggest fraud ever. It's not, like, the biggest... It's not the biggest deception that's ever happened. It's just another of many. It's just one of many. And it's not even on people's cultural radar. I mean, other than to make a joke once in... Like, a little cultural joke once in a while that includes Mormons.
Right.
And I didn't realize. It was kind of relieving, and it was kind of sad.
Now, how old are you? You're 24?
25.
You're 25.
Yeah.
Because, I think I started realizing this when I was in graduate school, and I was interested in legends and beliefs, and especially, like, religious beliefs and practices. So I looked at J-Dubs, I looked at the Amish, Pentecostals, there were Eastern religions. I read one book about the Hmong that's spelled with an H.
Yeah.
Hmong.
Yeah.
The Hmong.
The Hmong.
You know, the types of experiences that we're having might be specific to Mormonism in certain details, but when you pan back and you look at it from a larger perspective, they're the same types of experiences that people are having in other religions. So whether it's some kind of a blessing to heal the sick, or it's a prayer that you're saying, you know, there might be different ways of administering the blessing or trying to invoke the powers of heaven through prayer,
right.
But you're basically trying to do the same thing. And I don't know, Mormonism shrunk to me.
Yeah.
Then. And I think that's what you're saying, was the amazing shrinking Mormonism.
I want to butt in for a moment and give you a quick example of what I'm talking about here. So what you're hearing right now is called zikr, and it's a very powerful and common type of worship in Islam. It's a way of remembering the names of God. So people stand together in a group, and they move in unison to the beat of the drums. And after enough time, they fall into this group rhythm, and they begin to experience a sense of otherworldliness. And the zikr is seen as a way of tapping into and experiencing the divine. And there's this rhythm and pattern to zikr that we don't really have in Mormon worship, but we do fall into patterns and rhythms of repetition, especially certain times when we're remembering God's name.
The eternal Father, that they are always willing to take upon them the name of thy Son, and always remember him, and keep his commandments which he hath given them, that they may always have his Spirit to be with them. Amen.
Now, what you're hearing right now is a Pentecostal service where some young teenage girls are speaking in tongues. And if you watch this particular clip on YouTube, you'll see a very familiar scene. There's a lot of tears, some very sincere physical expressions of powerful emotion and contrition. And we don't really do this in Mormonism anymore with the whole speaking in tongues thing, but we certainly started out that way in the early days in Kirtland. But as I started looking at these things as a graduate student at Indiana University, and I started recognizing the familiar elements with my own religious experience, I had to figure out what to do with this, because I couldn't really just accept these things as true, genuine communication with God, because, as I'd been taught, only my particular brand of Mormon religious experience was of God. It's the way that He wants us to be, and everyone else is in some kind of error, you know, maybe misled by evil spirits, or at the very least, misled by the false traditions of men. That's how I was raised to view this. But now I was looking at things from an academic point of view, and I certainly couldn't get away with any kind of myopic, ethnocentric view as a graduate student at a top-tier public research university. And I couldn't say that my religion was right while everyone else's was wrong without coming off like a total douche. Now, I'm sort of okay coming off as a partial douche from time to time, but a total one? Yeah.
When I was young, it seemed that life was so wonderful. Logical, oh, intellectual, cynical.
that when you're raised in it, you kind of know that the world's out there,
right?
But all of your world is Mormonism,
right? And and the doctrine of Mormonism, like, doesn't require you, but it encourages you to kind of reinterpret all the entirety of human history through that lens, that everything has been leading up to the presence of your religion on the earth.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't even call that a reinterpretation, because that's how it's presented to you.
Yeah.
So that's just your foundation for the history of the world.
Right, right.
Starting with Adam and Eve.
Yeah, exactly. And you're taking the entirety of human history and you're running it through like this kind of Mormon processor and like Mormon worldview.
How many dispensations of time?
Well, I mean, it depends on what seal we're on.
Which one are we?
The seventh seal, dude.
Come on.
We're on the seventh seal.
There's been seven dispensations of time. We're either right at the end of the sixth or right at the beginning of the seventh, but probably towards the end of the sixth, because that's the whole Saturday's warrior. We're living at 11:59 p.m. on Saturday, you know,
right.
of the world kind
right.
of thing, you know. But, yeah, so you've got Adam as the first dispensation head. Do you remember this?
Yeah, yeah. So you have Adam and, like, it's like
Enoch?
Noah.
Enoch. And then Noah.
And then Noah. And then Moses, maybe?
Then Moses, Abraham. Does that give us five?
Yeah, Moses,
and then
Abraham,
Jesus. And then Joseph Smith.
Joseph Smith, got it.
And then it's going to be Jesus again.
Right.
You know, so he gets double.
Right, one,
but he
gets a double dip, but that's okay. It's okay if he puts his mouth in the bowl, because
he can
because right. you know he's him.
So yeah, I mean I get that, and that everything that we do now was done anciently.
I mean, to me, this
baptism,
is,
home teachers,
right. The temple ceremony,
ceremony.
There's that James E. Talmage interpretation of the. Of the Mount of Transfiguration.
You ever looked into masonry at all?
Not much.
Yeah.
Not much. I mean, I listened to a Mormon Expression podcast.
Yeah, there was a multi-part series a couple of years ago on that. I didn't listen to all of those, but it was really good. I think by then I was aware of most of it.
Mm-hmm.
I got a book once called The Hiram Key that was written by a couple of ex-Masons, and it was kind of like an expositor of sorts, you know, expose, and they were talking about the central myth of masonry with someone, I think the name is Hiram Abiff, that he was the master mason that hid all of the secrets in the Temple of Solomon, but he was killed, and so that I think the main ceremony that they do that's like, you know, in the temple, we do the recreation of the world and Adam and Eve and, you know, Lucifer and that whole thing.
Right.
What they do is recreating, I think, the murder of Hiram Abiff. And so the penalties and the oaths and tokens are that you're going to keep that secret safe.
Right.
I think that's what it is.
Okay.
So where are you now, Brother Jake? You don't think that Mormonism is all that special?
It's still special to me.
Why? How? How is it special?
It's special. I mean, it's like, it totally dominated my upbringing, and like, it's still very influential in the way that I see things, the way that I do things. And like, if I even act like it's not, I think it's crazy. So I don't know, it's still special to me, and my whole family's still part of the church. So it's always going to be very influential in my life. You know, it's always going to be something that's special to me, because there's no way I'm going to get to a point where it's just like, that never happened.
Yeah?
Yeah.
What? Oh! It being raised Mormon,
right? Exactly, and Mormon, you know, just being participating in Mormonism, that type of thing, and that's okay. I mean, it's okay that it's, you know, it's going to be
It'll be special to me forever. But
so you are the Elders Quorum instructor in your ward right now in North Carolina, is that right?
Yeah, yeah.
You like that?
Yeah, I enjoy it.
Why?
I mean, it's a nice... It helps me kind of think about things. There's a lot of interesting... There's a lot of interesting, like, concepts and you know, the concept of forgiveness, you know, which is something that is really hard to kind of wrap your head around if you really think, you know, when you really get down to it. Because if you think about forgiveness, if you forgive somebody or you don't forgive somebody, you kind of treat them the same way. So if your brother embezzled a bunch of money from you and he asks you for a bunch of money, like 10 years later, you probably wouldn't give it to him. But even if you forgave him or you didn't forgive him, you probably still wouldn't give him the money. So like at the end of the day, like you're out, like part of your outward actions are unaffected by whether or not you forgive somebody. So what is the purpose of forgiveness anyway? Is it just something where you don't allow something to make you feel angry anymore? Or, I mean, is it really a selfless act? Or is it more of like a self-preservation where just to avoid the, you know, the emotional tax of holding a grudge or being angry at somebody indefinitely? So like there are a lot of things like that that I think are interesting, that are interesting thoughts and things I want to talk about. So I get to talk about those things. I get to lead the discussion, which is nice.
But do you have people that are engaging in the discussion in ways that move it into areas you haven't thought about before? I mean, because to me it seems like that's what you're interested in. You want to explore things that you haven't explored before. That's why the ex-Mormon website isn't that compelling to you. After a while, you get bored with it because it's the same old stuff that you've seen before.
Right.
So, I mean, that was my experience with church and with Elders Quorum. It ultimately was not a satisfying approach or a satisfying conversation.
Yeah.
So, like, with forgiveness, you know, when you started talking about it, I was thinking, what is the main value of forgiveness for me? And I think for me, it's just letting go of whatever vitriol I have inside of me so that I'm not all tied up in knots and trying to seek revenge and things like that. And so there's a value to it in there. But then I wonder, is forgiveness even a worthwhile or a worthy ideal? Do you just set, if you're someone who's really quick and easy to forgive, are you just setting yourself up for abuse for the rest of your life?
Right.
You know, and so like when I think about religion and I think about the messages that are taught in religion, I think it's just kind of like common sense stuff that has been passed down through the ages. You know, things that you need to be able to exist in a social group and, you know, don't kill, don't lie, you know, just basic ethics, morality, whatever you want to call it. But I don't think of it as being something that a God says, this is what's important for you to know, and this is the way that it's important for you to know it.
Right.
I just think the reason that it's been passed along is because there's value to people, mm-hmm. you know, whatever that value is. So when you take something like forgiveness, I don't know. I don't know if there is like one absolute way to take it that it's good. Is forgiveness good? Is it good in all situations? How is it good? Is it good to you personally? Is it good for the person that you're forgiving?
Right.
I don't know. But I wouldn't be able to engage in a conversation like that in Elders Quorum. Because I couldn't say, let's separate forgiveness from all of this, all of the trappings of religion around it, all these assumptions and biases that you come into it from, and just try to talk about it as a isolated thing. Because as soon as you suggest there's not a God or that it's something that could exist outside of Mormonism, you know, people have shut off.
Right.
And most people. I mean, I'm sure there are people that would engage and stuff, but that's not really my experience with it.
And people are pretty willing to engage. And there have been a few times when I've genuinely seen, like, heard things that were surprising to me and were interesting to me. But at the same time, I'll admit that, like, I'm getting tired of it. Like, I'm kind of getting worn out of
the game.
The game. Yeah. Because I feel like there's a certain amount of, if you're not all in, you just don't really belong.
Yeah.
And that's just the way it is. Like, if you're not all in Mormonism, you don't really belong. And it's not that they'll kick you out. You just really don't have a place. You don't really have a place within Mormonism because there's no place they want to put you. Everything is built on the premise of absolute devotion to the religion. And, you know, unless you're at that point, there's certain aspects or there's certain aspects of Mormonism that are just totally inaccessible to you. Because basically the entire church operates as if you weren't there. Like, or not as if you weren't there, but the entire church, the doctrine, the teachings, everything operates as if people like you did not exist within the church.
Darling, you got to let me know, should I stay or should I go?
There's no acknowledgement that, like, this exists and that's okay, well, they can be here.
No, yeah, I think it's the second part, not the first part. I don't think it's a lack of acknowledgement of existence, but it's a lack of validation for the existence that it's okay.
Yeah.
You know, like, of course there's an awareness that there's people out there who ask questions, and that's why you've got this, you know, to be learned is good as long as you hearken to the counsels of God kind of thing, you know, and there's this whole anti-intellectual vein that runs through a lot of the church. So I think people are aware of it. You know, I mean, I think even with that quote from Packer that the three greatest enemies of the church are homosexuals and feminists and liberals, I think that's an acknowledgement that there are those liberals within the church, but it's not a welcoming, you know, or a validating, you know, whereas Uchtdorf might say, put all of your talents and our talents and we'll blend and we'll be better for it. And he kind of pays lip service to that. But I think you used the word devotion.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that'd be an interesting word to unpack. And also like respect. I mean, is it even seen to be respectful if you're questioning? Is that seen as an act of devotion or is it seen as an act of respect? I think most people would say that are outside of it, that aren't experiencing it, would say no. But I know for me, I always felt like it was the highest form of respect, that I was taking it seriously enough to be interested in it and ask the questions.
Mm.
And that was my devotion to it.
Right.
You know, what does devotion mean? It's like you're committing all of your time and your energy and your thought to it.
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah, no, I agree. There definitely is an acknowledgement. I guess I want to kind of backpedal on that. There definitely is an acknowledgement that those things exist. But there's also an implicit and explicit expectation that you act as if you didn't feel that way. Basically, it's okay to doubt as long as you keep your mouth shut. You know, like, it's okay to have doubts, but just act as if you didn't, and then they'll go away. I mean, that's...
Do you remember, I think we're going on 3 years now, almost exactly 3 years, when I stood up and bore my testimony, or non-testimony, or whatever you want to call it, which was really a reaction to the first counselor. This was like, it was November fast and testimony meeting right after Packer had said what he said about homosexuals. You know, why would a loving heavenly father do that?
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And so we had that first counselor get up and really condemn any form of cafeteria Mormonism. You can't just pick and choose the things that you accept from what the brethren says, that you've got to take 100% or there's no room for you. And that really riled me up. And so I stood up and said, well, is there room for me? You know, because there's things that they say that I accept and things that I don't. And at the end of that meeting, our bishop got up and do you remember how he approached that, what he said about it?
I remember the one phrase that I think he said word for word, or maybe this is just a feeling I got from it, but I remember him saying, of course there's room for you.
He said, of course there's room for you. And, you know, he said the church was founded on, you know, someone who asked questions and Joseph Smith, and that as long as we are asking questions faithfully, it's a good thing. And that's where I think you get caught up, because you can't ask questions faithfully. Like, it's almost like there's this expectation, as long as you ask questions, but you already know what the answer is going to be, but you kind of explore what some of the other possibilities could be, but you already know that the outcome is that it's true. Right. You know, that's being faithful.
Yeah.
You know, you're not going to reject the things that you're questioning.
Yeah.
You're just going to explore that. And so as long as you've got a hand on the iron rod, you can reach out and feel amongst the weeds or whatever, you know,
right.
But don't let go of that iron rod, which is the knowledge that it's true, or whatever metaphor you want to use for it. So I think that's where why are we talking about this? I don't remember.
Yeah, I mean, the reason we were talking about that is because I was talking about I'm kind of getting worn out because...
How's Erica? Is she getting worn out too? Or is she...
I think I'm getting worn down. I don't think she is too much. I don't know. We're not exactly on the same page.
Uh-oh.
If I go, there will be trouble. And if I stay, it will be double.
I mean, it's not, like, totally different. I think
should I turn that off now?
No, okay. It's fine.
Yeah.
This is strictly off the record. But, no, it's it could be on the record. I mean, I don't think we're exactly on the same page. I mean, if she said...
I don't ever want to go anymore.
We're done. I would say, great.
Woohoo!
Yeah, we're done.
Yeah.
But, I don't know.
So what do you think keeps her in?
I don't know. I think it's more of a spiritual connection. I think she has more of a spiritual connection, too.
What does that mean?
I don't know. It's more emotionally satisfying for her than it is for me, maybe.
Yeah. I don't understand the spiritual things. I don't.
What do you mean?
Like, I don't understand what it means. When people talk about the church being spiritually fulfilling,
or that you should engage it on a spiritual way, or that you're spiritually malnourished, or, you know,
like, what is that? I don't know what that means. I don't experience things that way, so I don't know what it means.
You don't experience things spiritually?
I don't know what that means.
I mean, so, how would you interpret, I mean, do you feel like you've had spiritual experiences? Within Mormonism, are there experiences that you interpreted at the time as being spiritual experiences?
Yeah, of course.
And what were those experiences like?
They're like the warm, fuzzy emotions. I mean, I think what you said about, like, emotionally satisfying is probably the thing, but it was always, like, a confirmation of, like, what I'm doing right now is right. It was like self-validation.
Mm.
It was, okay, yeah. And so I just... So is that what's... But so within that context, and to me that's like a very cynical deconstruction of spirituality.
Mm. Just emotions, right?
Yeah. And that I get, but like I don't understand like being in it. I don't know how to say it. I don't understand how people don't see it that way, I guess is what.
Yeah.
I don't understand how to not see it cynically.
I guess I think the way to see it, to not see it cynically, would be well, how do you view emotions? Like, what is the purpose of emotions and what is the role of emotions?
I'm getting really uncomfortable with this conversation, with this direction that we're going. I don't know. The role of emotions.
Yeah, the role of emotions. What
you
is
mean,
the purpose?
Evolutionary, why emotions developed? Is that what you're asking about?
Right. Well, the thing is, what I'm getting at, I should be more transparent. What I'm getting at is...
Where are you leading me, Jake?
Do you view emotions as being some sort of, like, lesser form of knowledge about something? Or some
of
like
knowledge,
like a hindrance
on rationality, or like basically do you view emotions as being primarily in a primarily pejorative context?
No,
or?
I don't take a pejorative view on emotions. I think emotions are a way of experiencing life and it kind of immersing yourself in life. So if that's spirituality, that you're immersing yourself in this community or, you know, whatever it is, and you're experiencing these extreme emotions that are self-validating emotions. I mean, I can understand that, I guess, but I don't feel it. I don't engage in that.
So I think the main difference between, from what I can, what comes to mind anyway, is that the main difference between like spirituality, just kind of general spirituality, and then religious spirituality is that religious spirituality, the idea is that religious spirituality corresponds with some sort of objective omnipotent force or being, that somehow it's connected to some sort of something that's outside of just the emotions of the people involved, and it actually corresponds with a deity.
That's the religious form of spirituality.
That would be the kind of religious form.
So like a connection to that deity.
Yeah. But spirituality, I think, can also be
like... To me, that's that self-validation thing, because that's like, oh, God knows who I am. He cares. He loves me. He has a plan for me.
Yeah.
Jesus died for me, and he knew exactly what I was going to be going through right at this moment. The small details of my life, he's interested in and he's invested in.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you have that belief and that longing, then the emotions that come through and you're like, oh, yeah, this is real. He really is there. You know, it can be like very powerful and overwhelming and but I don't know what causes those. What causes those? Is it just the desire to have them?
I don't know. Maybe there is. Maybe he is. Maybe it's the spirit.
Shut up.
Well, I mean, I don't know.
You really think that?
I mean, existence with a God and existence without a God are kind of equally baffling to me. Because, like, if nothing, I mean, if things just kind of sprang into being, that just sounds, I mean, it's hard to even conceptualize that. But it's equally hard to conceptualize that there's some sort of force that's like in charge of it.
So, do you consider yourself a materialist or a dualist? This was one of the questions that we asked on the Infants on Throne survey, you know, and it kind of came to my awareness. Like I understood the concepts, but not really the terminology for them.
Yeah, you're gonna definitely have to go through that again.
When I was. Having one of these conversations with the guys on the podcast, and especially Scott, who we call Jesse, but I think he's going to start going by Scott now because we're kind of.
I had no idea. Maybe you told me this, and I just didn't realize it.
Yeah,
I did not realize.
Matt's going to do a missionary story episode with him sometime.
Okay,
and that's going to be his big coming out. But I've been dropping little hints because I'm impatient.
Right.
But anyway, so he was talking about materialists and dualists, and I just didn't get it. I think it was when we were talking about the Krista, the psychic, and, mm-hmm. you know, their reactions to it, and that they just did not accept any discussion that was a dualist discussion,
mm-hmm.
because they reject dualism outright. So the dualist is this idea of a spirit or some part of yourself that exists outside of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the dual nature of you, that you do have a spirit. It's the whole hand and glove thing,
right?
Primary,
yeah, got it.
And whereas materialist is it's all just your brain.
It's the alignment of the neurons in your brain.
That's it.
Okay,
that's what it is. And when you die, everything that's inside of you dies with you. You know, there isn't a consciousness that continues afterwards. So there wouldn't be, you know, in the context of this discussion on spirituality, a material explanation, which I think is where I lean on this, mm-hmm. is that there are these neurons or whatever that are firing and creating this emotion, this feeling that you have, that are there to validate a belief that you have. Whereas I think what you were suggesting is maybe there really is something outside of yourself, a dualist perspective. Maybe there is something outside, and maybe it's God, maybe it's the spirit, you know.
I would say my hunch is with materialism, but I'm kind of a hopeful for dualism, because the thought of non-existence is terrifying.
Why?
Because because it is terrifying. That's all I know is existence. And, like, I like existing. It's fun. Shiny.
So out of 188 people who've responded to the survey, we're at 32%. So a third of our audience that answered this consider themselves materialist, definitely. 15% have said that they're dualist, that they know that they are. But then more than 50%. So we're like 24% say a little of both sometimes, which I think a true materialist would say, well, then you're not one of us.
Right.
And, you know, then the other 29% say, I don't know what it is.
Right.
So you would be in that a little of both sometimes camp, you think? Because your pragmatism pushes you towards materialism, but your hopefulness pushes you towards dualism.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I would say.
Yeah. So I think that would be dualist. If we're being really strict with terms, because you leave that possibility open.
So just leave the possibility open is...
I think so.
Is dualism. So dualism is the more inclusive. Materialism seems pretty exclusive. You gotta interpret it this way, or you're not a materialist.
Right. You because a materialist would say that there is... Yeah. Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, exclusive has that pejorative connotation, so that's why there's a little bit of resistance there. But I think, yeah, you would be excluding anything that is a possible explanation for a dualistic possibility.
Yeah, and I kind of meant to be pejorative, because I think people who are strict materialists are...
Assholes? You think they're assholes, Brother Jake?
I think they're assholes. No, I think that they're fooling themselves on what you can actually know. And what I'm saying is, like, a true materialist would recognize the limitations of their knowledge. And I think the limitations of the knowledge is, this is probably true. This is probably how it is. But there is no objective measure to eliminate any doubt about this.
I don't know. I'm going to be playing the devil's advocate here, because I'm not a strict materialist. I don't really even ever play one on TV. But I did stay at a Holiday Inn Express last night. That's old. That's old. I don't know.
That was a good one.
Yeah, all right.
I mean, that was a great commercial. I loved that commercial.
but I mean, thinking about Randy and how Randy would respond to something like this, I think that he would say that he's not, or that he does acknowledge the limitation of his own knowledge. He absolutely acknowledges those limits. Mm-hmm. And he acknowledges them so truthfully that he doesn't try to go beyond those limits to look for, any kind of explanation for things. He sticks with those limits. This is all that I know. This is all that can be proven. And so anything outside of that is kind of out of bounds, you know. And I, right. I side more with you, because I think the way that those limits get stretched is by going outside of them and taking a skeptical approach, of course, and scientific method, and trying to learn about things. And, you know, how can you say that there's not some kind of a spirit that animates our body? Well, because there's never, we can't prove that there is.
Right.
You know, I mean, what if you could prove that there was, what would that be like? I don't know. I don't think it's a ridiculous pursuit to try to, explore that. I'm interested in exploring it, but, you know, I don't know.
Right, and there have been some ways to explore it. Like, well, one, and this is a pretty trivial exploration, but there's kind of this anecdotal, and this may just be kind of a folklore idea, but or this may just be kind of a like an urban legend type thing. But I have heard of, from just totally non reputable sources.
Non-reputable?
No, but I mean, they're not. I mean, it's not like I heard this from somebody who did. Yeah, it's not like ill repute. I didn't hear it from a hooker, but like I. It's definitely third hand, so nothing wrong. Not that there's anything wrong with that. I apologize to all the hookers. I just offended.
That's that's our next survey question.
Right?
Are you a hooker? Yeah, a little bit of both. Sometime. That's what we're kind of aiming for.
I don't know.
I don't know. Do you count dishes and laundry as payment? I don't know.
What I'm saying is that there have been like doctors or hospitals that will like write things on top of. If you've heard of this, they'll like so they'll have equipment or. They'll have equipment or you know, dressers or something, and they'll write stuff on top of them because people often...
when they're describing a near-death experience.
Right, an out-of-body experience, right. And they hover above their own body.
Right.
They write these things that basically you'd only be able to see if you were actually hovering above them.
Right.
So they ask them, did they see any of those things? And, you know, they say no. But that's not a very... That's not, like, a rigorous...
No, but that's a...
Thing.
But no, but, I mean, that's an attempt... And it falls towards materialism there because they're not able to describe the things that are there in the room that they're unaware of.
Right.
So if there's something that they're aware of, then, of course, you can imagine that in your mind. But if you're going outside of that, you should be able to see those things. So,
right.
Yeah. But so you mean even constructing an experiment like that to try to provide evidence of a consciousness and a near-death experience... That's a worthwhile experiment to...
It's definitely interesting. I mean, I don't think it's worth like a... I don't think anyone should get a Nobel Prize for it, but I think that it would be... sure, it's interesting. I mean, it's interesting to talk about the limits of those bounds. And if you talk about, like, to me, the thing that allows me to feel just a little bit okay about the possibility of dualism is, like, the emotional connection that I can have with somebody, like people that I'm very good friends with in a very short amount of time, like the emotional connection I feel makes me think like, man, what if we're connecting on something more than just like what words have been exchanged up to this point? And you know, I'm definitely open to the, I mean, that would be interesting, but I mean, it's probably not. I mean, honestly, like my hunch is there's probably a bunch of like very subconscious cues that I'm picking up that are firing off these neurons of trust and acceptance and belonging that are, you know, that are objectively observable. I'm just not really consciously taking them in, but subconsciously they're creating this emotion that I feel. And that's very possible, and it's probably the case, but I'd like to think that maybe there's something else.
So that, like, if you meet somebody and then you start doing laundry over at their house... And they start giving you a little good-natured ribbing. You know, they give you a little shit for it.
Right.
That dualistic sense of connection can overcome even the obnoxious giving shit for those kinds of things.
Exactly. What I'm saying is we've been brought together, Glenn. We've been together by the dualism of our existence.
Yeah. Well, I was assigned as your home teacher in that...
Revelation. You
know, that was revelation.
Revelation.
That happened. Yeah. So, and it was also that you could do Brother Jake videos on YouTube.
Right. So now I can have literally thousands, three thousands.
Do you know what your viewership is?
Well, I mean, subscribers, it's over 800.
Wow. You're bigger than us, man.
Really?
Yeah.
People in my program started running across them.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I had a few people come up to me and they're like, so that was a joke, right?
Yeah.
Like, they're like, that was, you're joking? Are you joking? And I was like, yes, I'm joking.
Because they don't know anything about Mormonism.
I wasn't sure. Yeah. So they watched like the racism and sexism one and they're like, yeah. And there were people like, I really thought I was going to have to not be your friend anymore.
Uh-huh.
But, you know.
If you were serious.
If I was serious, then they would have written me off as a friend.
Wow.
But since I wasn't...
See, that's because they have not been raised understanding the important principle of forgiveness.
That's it. That's it. That all-powerful, important, good principle.
They need that in their life.
Yeah. I think we all do.
Yeah.
I forgave you because of our dualistic connection.
Oh, the laundry thing?
And you forgave me.
For bringing it up?
For
You never came back and did laundry again after that, though.
Yeah, I did.
Did you?
Yeah, after you started giving a shit. Yeah, we come back. We just complain about you giving a shit.
No, but when you finally, like, broke down and said, it kind of hurts our feelings. You never did after that.
Did we
not? I don't think. I don't know. I'm not keeping track.
Really. I think we did. Yeah. I think we did. Because you were like, oh, I'm sorry. It really was a joke.
Yeah.
All right, man. I'm worn out.
You want to play?
Yeah.
Okay. You don't have any, like, final things to say?
I don't know. I kind of want to do this intro. I don't want to do an intro. I don't know. I was thinking about the thing that made me think of this. Well, other than the ex-Jehovah's Witness. But there was this one time that I thought, what if the sun is just a mitochondria in a giant, and the universe is like an organism, and like,
you're just now thinking of that?
I never thought of
that
before.
You're just now?
Yeah,
is that? Come on, man. Seventh grade, dude. As soon as I got introduced to biology and like cellular biology, of course. It's like,
well, will you do that?
Well, what if a nucleus is just like the sun of a solar system, and everything smaller and bigger and bigger. And, you know.
Yeah. So
what if we are just cells inside of God's body?
Yeah. So what if you did that as an intro?
Because it was
Right. You're like, back when I was in seventh grade, I had this thought. We probably all had it.
I don't know.
What if the thing?
What if the thing?
We didn't really talk.
I remember laying on my bed as a little kid and imagining the immenseness of space. And I'm talking like 5 or 6 years old. And feeling like my pillow could swallow me. Because I'd go to sleep saying what I'm thankful for in my prayers. And I was thankful for gravity. I was really thankful, genuinely thankful for gravity. Because if there was no gravity, I would just be floating.
Yeah.
And what would I wouldn't even be floating towards anything. Because there wouldn't be a gravitational pull pulling me towards anything. Right. I would just, so like even the pillow underneath my head wouldn't still be underneath my head. You know, like these were really like profound thoughts like for somebody as young as I was. Yeah, yeah, like really, I didn't do anything profound with them. I just, it was kind of like, wow, if there was no Earth, then I wouldn't be here. I'd be falling, but I wouldn't have anything to fall towards. And, you know, it was like this kind of domino effect in my young mind.
So. Yeah.
Yeah, so I don't think you're all that special for thinking that just now.
No, I mean,
because I did it. Totally did it when I was like 5.
Beat
so come
you,
on.
Beat you.
Trumped him. Yeah. You're going to forgive me for that too, right?
I will.
Okay, all right.
Because it's a good thing. Nice. All right, yeah, I don't really have any closing thoughts. Okay.
Well, why don't you get anyone for the closing prayer?
Anyone for the closing prayer?
You have a way of connecting with people that I wish that I had. I come across as being a little bit jaded about it. Maybe I am jaded.
No, you come across to people as a big bear of a dipshit. I feel like people see you and they're like, oh my God, I'm better than that guy. And they look at you and they say, that fat fuck. They taught him how to stand with a monkey and hold a baby. And now look at him go.
Thanks, man.